Good evening, everybody, and welcome to tonight's event, the last in the 2009-2010 series of public events with Professor Martin Amos. My name is John McAuliffe, and I co-direct the Centre for New Writing here at the University of Manchester. And tonight's event will follow the usual format for our events. So I'll briefly introduce our speakers, and then Martin, Blake, and John will each speak for about 5 minutes or so on the subject of literature and violence. And after that, we'll have a discussion of the subject that will arise from their statements, and then we'll open it up to questions from the floor. Martin Amos is Professor of Creative Writing at Manchester, a brilliant essayist and critic, and one of the world's leading novelists. Martin's early novels, including Dead Babies and Success, were our original and grotesque comedies, his treatment of violence and masculinity he returned to in his underestimated and misunderstood novel, Yellow Dog. His most recent work is The Pregnant Widow, which was welcomed in remarkably unviolent terms by Edmund White in the New York Review of Books lately, as this strange, sparkling novel through which beauty has re-entered literature. Which is nice. Blake Morrison grew up in Yorkshire and worked as an editor at the TLS, Observer, and The Independent on Sunday until 1995. Since 2003, Blake has been professor of creative and life writing at Goldsmiths College. His books include studies of Seamus Heaney and the Poets of the Movement, a long poem, The Ballad of the Yorkshire Ripper, two prize-winning memoirs, and When Did You Last See Your Father, and Things My Mother Never Told Me, and most recently, two novels, South of the River, and last month, The Last Weekend. He's also written a non-fiction book, As If, a moving and passionate account of the trial in Preston of the two boys tried for the murder of Jamie Bulger. John Gray is one of the UK's most eminent public intellectuals. He is, in John Banville's words, a dedicated foe of the Enlightenment, and was an early critic of global finance, one of the first in his 1998 book, False Dawn, to call the current recession. He has more recently identified and discussed the very modern conjunction of violence, utopianism, and apocalyptic religion. Emeritus Professor of European Thought at the LSE, his books include Straw Dogs and a selected essays titled Grey's Anatomy, which is just out in paperback from Penguin. So ladies and gentlemen, please welcome tonight's speakers.
Good evening. Thank you all very much for coming, and I hope you can all hear me. I think I know you well enough by now, after, 3 or 4 years, to confide that it's been a very mortal week for me, this last. Yesterday I learned that my closest friend, Christopher Hitchens, has been diagnosed with cancer of the esophagus, and last Thursday my mother died. I always used to say that I got on very well with my mother, so well because we were the same age. And she, in fact, was only 19 when she had my brother, who was only a year older than me. But that age gap was there. It's proved to be decisive. It was a very good death. And she was a very remarkable woman. And as I often told her, in terms of my genetic inheritance, I got at least as much from her as I got from my father. I'll just tell two very brief anecdotes about her. One that I think very much sums up our low bohemian household in Swansea in the 50s. When I was filling out a form for school, and there was one category that made me uneasy, and it said religion. Couldn't then put none, and you couldn't put, as I would now put, agnostic. And I went out into the hall and shouted up the stairs. I said, "Mom, what religion are we?" And there was a very long silence, and she said, "Church of England." And I felt such relief, and, you know, good old Church of England, didn't ask a damn thing for me. And the other thing she said, she wasn't at all literary, but she was a great reader, but not literary, a sort of innocent, but very straight. And I think I must have been about 10, and I said, what's all this about Hitler? I'd seen some images of the smokestacks and the rail tracks, and she said, oh, don't worry about Hitler. You've got blonde hair and blue eyes. Hitler would have loved you. So I took some unworthy comfort from that. But I think that's why, probably, that's why I wrote a novel about Nazism and feel that I probably will write another one before I too die. And here's a sort of leaving the subject to my mother, that here's an odd insight that has been confirmed by this last week. It's remarkable how many men commit suicide after their mothers die, and suicide being a very predominantly male activity. And I always suspected and now know that it's not because they suddenly want to, it's because they suddenly can. And this is the nature of the strange symbiosis between mothers and sons. I'd like to ask the question, what is violence? This curse of our species. And, you know, just as war is diplomacy by other means, violence is a continuation of the argument by other means. And I was shocked, but not after a while, very surprised to learn that the most common cause of death for women between the ages of 16 and 45 in this country and in many others is murder by male partner. And we all know what that means. That means that the men run out of words and fall back on masculine bulk and anger. when violence intrudes into our own lives, into our middle class kitchen sink existences, it always strikes me as a visitation from another genre. You know, we live by these normal conventions, and then suddenly these alien and repulsive conventions are established where all the rules have changed. It's like it's suddenly when it happens near you, it's as if you're in a malign episode of Candid Camera, where it all looks staged, and again, everything is estranged from your normal rhythms. And there was, in fact, a really vicious Candid Camera that couldn't possibly happen now, but I remember watching it as a young man, where the setup was a dry cleaning store with a fishbowl in it. And the stunt was that while some old dear was collecting her laundry, and the victims of this stunt were all women, the cheerful Candid Camera chap would come in, reach into the fishbowl with a sliver of carrot in his hand, goldfish bowl, and then take it out like that and eat it. And cheerfully converse while crunching away. And the first two women just bent over the counter in numb horror. But the third woman spoke for all of us when she just said, she looked at him and said, "You horrible man. You ate that thing alive. You horrible man," she said. And that's, I think, a very normal reaction to violence. And it's always struck me, too, as something like a category error of violence, as a solution, an immediate solution that isn't ever a solution, that is just a point along a chain, the chain of violence rather than the cycle of violence. And I wonder how literally or historically true it is when Vasily Grossman, the Tolstoy of the USSR, says, as he says it more than once, that nothing achieved by violence ever stands. It never lasts. It's doomed to disappear. And he said that the end justifies the means. It doesn't work because means define ends. And the project, you know, to kill millions of people to create a paradise is always poisoned by the time you're, you know, a tenth of the way there. Both this sense of a category error and a change of genre are beautifully caught in a sentence of Saul Bellow's, sort of one-sentence expression of genius. Augie March, in the novel of that name, is helping his older brother at a weighing station in Depression Chicago, and they're weighing coal. And a drunken Polish guy comes in and has a row and dumps his coal, not on the scales, but on the ground. And Augie's older brother, Simon, takes a pistol from his desk and walks out, and Augie watches. And he doesn't shoot him, he pistol whips him across the face. And it goes, my heart went back on me as the cuts were torn. And I thought, does it make him think he knows what he's doing if the guy bleeds? And you have to think about that sentence, and it's a very mysterious sentence, but I think captures the essence of the shift to violence. To speak personally, writing about violence puts a certain strain on the reader that no other subject quite does, in that you're talking about pain and suffering that you haven't necessarily experienced yourself and find it very hard to imagine. And, you know, so often I read descriptions of violence, you know, with a left and a right, he put him on the ground or something, that I feel are fundamentally unearned, that they just haven't, the writer hasn't earned the right to address this subject yet. And what is it that gives you the right? To talk about political violence and historical violence, I've written a novel about the Holocaust and a novel about the Gulag. And while I think we all agree that the Holocaust is substantially and definably more vicious and disgusting historical crime, I found it relatively easy to write about because I was writing from the point of view of a perpetrator, a Nazi doctor. When it came to writing about the victims, which I had to do with the novel House of Meetings, it was entirely different and very disturbing in a different way. And I realized that what I had to do was, what I'd had to do was suffer. And you can't do that. You can't sort of go to the gulag, and you can't put yourself through anything remotely similar to what they went through. The degradation and the hunger and the cold. And I was living in Uruguay with my beautiful wife and my beautiful daughters in a country where there is no stress. Everyone's incredibly nice to you. You can do what you like. You can park any way you like. You don't need car insurance. There are no, the only law in the country is against abortion, basically. And I couldn't do any of that suffering, so I just had to do writer's suffering. And every writer knows what that is. You go into your study and the subconscious is turned off. Norma Mailer, who's very good on this, on writing, said that you expect when you come to a scene that your subconscious will have done much of the work and then that you will be halfway there before you start. And I've always found that to be true. In fact, I agree with John Gray that the subconscious does practically everything. And I can just lie in a hammock with a drink and let my subconscious do it all. But it would be a good description of writer's block, I think, to say that writer's block is when the subconscious is switched off. And that's what it felt like. And every scene, every page was Sisyphean, rolling the ball to the top of the hill, and then it came down again. And also, I felt, after I finished it, a great disgust for what I'd done. And it was only, you know, months later when I read it in proof, and again, at the last minute, having put it off, that I could... feel that it was something I was, you know, proud of and not ashamed of. I want to just end by tossing this in the air, that in John Gray's very stimulating book, which I reread, Straw Dogs, he comes close to saying, well, his position is that we are no different to other animals. But I think, and he hedges around this question, but I think our awareness of death decisively marks us off from other animals. And it's not just an acceptance, an intellectual acceptance of death at a certain age. As it's been quite carefully mapped by Freud and others, that it begins in childhood with the death of a pet, and then the death of a grandparent, and then it grows, and then in your 40s you accept your own death unequivocally, and then when you get to my age, the feeling is that this can't turn out well. But I think that the violent impulse is a defense against death, that it's you inflict it lest it be inflicted on you, and that this death awareness does make us this ingeniously violent species. Thank you.
Yeah. In my first year at university, in my hall of residence, I put up photographs not of pop stars or footballers, but of the My Lai Vietnam atrocity. Photographs from the Sunday Times Colour magazine about this murder of 50 or so Vietnamese civilians by US Lieutenant Cali.
More than that,
maybe. 500. Yeah, 500. And, you know, they were pinned above my bed. And I sometimes look back at my young self and wonder about that. Was I... what kind of sick, macabre imagination was this? How could I sleep at night? What was it about? I suppose it may have been the result of somebody who'd read a lot of Wilfred Owen and who believed in the importance of portraying war honestly in all its brutality. It may have been a challenge, could I take this, looking at this. Partly I think it's just a kind of exercise in realism. This is what the world is like outside the ivory tower I'm in at university, or what some parts of the world are like. And it's important to acknowledge that. And there's always been war in literature, and there's always been violence in literature, public and domestic violence, violence against men, women, children. And there'll always be critics who object to the depiction of violence in literature as the writer glorifying in it, or getting off on it, or indulging the vicious taste of the reading public. But I would defend to the death the writer's right to describe death and violent death, however horrific. It's a way of shedding light in dark places. It's a way of making people see. Primo Levi says, you know, it talks about it as entering an abyss of viciousness, but as something that has to be done if you believe you can somehow stop the cycle of violence. Well, if you take it on as a subject, I think you have to do it as well as you possibly can. I think Martin has said sex is difficult to write about, violence no less difficult. You've got to be inventive, you've got to be clear, flexible, imaginative, in a way maybe that war generals and serial killers are not imaginative. Homer understood this very well. Among the many violent deaths in the Iliad, there's one that describes that of Thestor in a chariot. Patroclus, coming close up to him, stabbed with a spear thrust at the right side of the jaw and drove it on through the teeth, then hooked and dragged him with the spear over the rail, as a fisherman who sits out on the jut of a rock with line and glittering bronze hook drags a fish who is thus doomed out of the water. It's a beautiful image, and when artists make beauty out of terror, there's always some unease about it, obviously. Susan Sontag, in her book regarding the pain of others, is very good on this subject. She's talking mainly about photography, war photography, and says, you know, that I'm quoting here, she says, "Photography that bears witness to the calamitous and the reprehensible is much criticised if it seems aesthetic, that is, too much like art, that draws attention to itself rather than to the medium, rather than to what's being depicted." Well, I kind of understand that objection, you know, the writer paring his fingernails when something terrible is being described, but, and you know, I understand the desire for something that's not precious, exquisite, but I think it's wrong. I mean, I don't think that the wobbling handheld camera or the shaky pen, though they might be more authentic, are the right way to approach violence. Atrocity is no excuse for bad writing. On the contrary, the writer doing violence has to be incisive to hit the mark, to make it new. Now, when Christopher Loeb comes to redo Homer's Iliad in his war music, when he comes to that image of Patroclus dragging his victim from the chariot like a fisherman hooking a fish, he sees, you know, he can't just repeat that image, he has to find another way to do it. So he has this: "As gracefully as men in oilskins cast fake insects over trout, he speared the boy, and with his hip, his pivot prized Thestor up and out, as easily as later men disengage a sardine from a tin." The tin of sardines, like the curve of the chariot, is again, it's a brilliant image. Or think of Ted Hughes redoing Ovid and the death of Actaeon. Actaeon torn apart by his own hounds. He talks about the pack poured onto him like an avalanche. Then began the tugging and the ripping. And this is the good beginning. "His head and antlers reared from the heaving pile and swayed like the signalling arm of somebody drowning in surf." I think it's possible to write about violence without sensationalising it. Of course it is. And of those who've done so in our own time, about violence in our own time, I would say that Seamus Heaney is exemplary, in part because of the candour with which he dissects his own complicity with violence. He has a poem in North where he talks about, where he compares the punishment of a woman 2,000 years ago, punishment for her adultery. She's hanged, she's thrown into the bog, and he compares it with the tarring and feathering of Catholic girls who've gone out with British soldiers, the tarring and feathering by their own community. The poem is full of tenderness, of pity for the female victim, but it's also self-accusing. Heaney says, "I, who have stood dumb while your betraying sisters called in tar, wept by the railings, who would connive in civilized outrage, yet understand the exact and tribal intimate revenge." I mean, it's easy to connive in civilized outrage about violence. That's what that exam board did when they banned Carol Ann Duffy's poem about the young guy with a knife who was about to go out and commit knife crimes. I mean, what Carol Ann Duffy does, is trying to do in that poem, is to inhabit the mind of somebody who's about to commit violence. as Shakespeare does in Macbeth, if you like, as Dostoevsky does in Crime and Punishment, as Camus does in L'Étranger, as Anthony Burgess does in The Clockwork Orange, and as Seamus Heaney does. It's a tougher thing than conniving in civilised outrage, but it's more valuable. And I'd say, this will sound far-fetched, but I would say that Seamus Heaney, in his small way, by exploring that sort of hard tribal self of his, but then discovering, you know, a deeper, gentler, more agile, more forgiving, more compromising self, and celebrating that in some small way, those poems of his have created a sort of path towards non-violence, have contributed to the peace process. So you don't censor out violence, you look at it in the face. Of course, there's always a danger you'll be misunderstood or willfully misrepresented if you're a man writing about violence against women, or if you're anybody writing about violence against children, you may get in trouble for it. I kind of, in a way, got into trouble twice. Once with a long poem, The Ballad of the Yorkshire Ripper, about Peter Sutcliffe. Once with the book about the Bulger case, as if. Both of these, of course, were notorious cases done to death in the media. And I think the media never likes it when somebody else from outside, a writer, a novelist, a poet, comes in on their territory. There's a sense of ownership. They feel they've colonised that crime and nobody else should be there. But, of course, if you come at it in a different way, you can sometimes open things up, shed a bit of light. With the Bulger case, you know, there was the famous quote from John Major, "We must condemn a little more and understand a little less." Understand a little less. What a slogan. And the writer always has to understand a little more. And for me, the interest in both those cases is not the violence itself, it's what brought it about. Still, I could hardly leave the violence out altogether. In the case of the ballad, I invented a narrator who has a stronger stomach and a thicker Yorkshire accent than I have, and who can deliver certain lines that I still find hard to read out. I've never read this one, but you know, this is a stanza from it. You know, this is about Sutcliffe. "He were a one-man abattoir. He cleaved girls in halves, he shish kebabbed their pupils, he bled them dry like calves." For the sake of the poem, for the sake of understanding Sutcliffe, you need perhaps such lines. But violence is risky, and violence in literature is risky. And if you're always likely to be accused of presenting your monsters more sympathetically than the victims. I think Truman Capote had that thrown at him about In Cold Blood. You might be accused yourself of being a monster, or encouraging your readers to be monsters. And you do have to accept that there will always be people who kind of miss the point, where you've set something down that you're repelled by, they might be titillated and excited by. Still, you know, that's part of the business. You've got to try and incorporate the real world as much as it as you can. The violence has to be there. And in the end, the decision isn't about content, it's about style. It's about not whether you do it, but how you do it.
Okay. Well, what I have to say, I think, follows on pretty directly from what Martin has said and what Blake has just said. And I thought I'd talk about J.G. Ballard's novel Crash, which is about a particular type of violence, mainly violence that people do to themselves and to more or less willing partners, with a particular goal in mind. And this, Martin's absolutely right when he says that in my earlier writings. I've not really addressed this crucial difference, certainly not sufficiently, between humans and other animals, in relation to death, because I think he's absolutely right about that. Because it's not only that humans are aware of their deaths, of their coming death in a way that other animals appear not to be. It's that humans are put in a position where some of them respond to this knowledge by contriving their deaths, by contriving, doing violence to themselves or performing other actions which give them a death of a certain kind. And as if by telepathy or coincidence, when Martin said that, I went back to this page in Crash where Ballard refers to one of the protagonists who'd been seeking some kind of erotic release in by death in a car crash. He said, across the dirt, he writes, across the deserted side streets and pedestrian precincts, the concourses of the silent airport, the spectators move towards this huge stage, drawn there by the logic and beauty of Vaughan's death. The logic and beauty of Vaughan's death. Now, that's a kind of frightening and dangerous way of representing a certain type of suicidal behaviour. And in fact, Ballard, when he submitted this novel to a publisher, one of the readers in the comments wrote that the author is clearly beyond psychiatric help, which Ballard said it was the most thrilling compliment he'd ever received in his entire life. And of course, there is a sense in which he's exploring the very limits of obsession and a certain type of madness. But what does it tell you about violence? And when I was thinking about this topic, I was thinking of other writers and how they represent violence. There's a small class of writers. I would pick out the novelist Patricia Highsmith as being one, who represent violence, so to speak, instrumentally or clinically, without any ethical judgment at all. Well, I suppose the whole point of the Ripley novels, but also of much else that she wrote, is that the central protagonist in the Ripley novels uses violence to solve life problems. Doesn't actually derive any psychic kick from violence. Violence isn't necessary to the protagonist Ripley's, so to speak, psychological well-being or health. There's nothing that she ever writes about it which suggests that he's excited by it. But he simply responds to, including the ultimate violence of murder, when it seems a way out of a problem he faces, and he doesn't seek those problems. He seeks to retire in quiet wealth with his French wife out in a chateau in France, and he stays there for as long as he can, enjoying the quiet life that he has there of wealth, until problems arise from his past life which lead him to go out and kill again. But I think that's very rare, because I think the Highsmith picture of the role of violence in human life is something like this, that all human relations are tainted by criminality. All human relations have a potential of violence in them. But she doesn't go on and say, as perhaps Graham Greenwood or before Graham Greene, Dostoevsky, that's evil. The very category of evil is lacking in Highsmith. It's interesting that her books never sold in her native America. She made no impact at all there. But it's kind of very alien to a culture, even a literary culture, which can represent violence demonically or heroically, as perhaps in Cormac McCarthy, but except maybe in a few pulp novels, crime novels, hardly ever clinically. Hardly ever just as something someone uses without being excited by it to solve life problems. That's what I think she did. And she just dispensed with, in a sense, moral categories altogether. And that, I think, is what people find frightening about her writings, which are still not, I think, fully appreciated. But Ballard went one stage further. He did not, I think, aestheticize violence in the way that, for example, some fascist writers before, in the interwar period and even in the war, tried to find some redemptive features in violence itself. He didn't do that. What he did was he eroticized violence, or if you like, he called attention to the way in which certain types of violence have a role in the way we live our lives and the way we think about our lives. Now, of course, one of the things he did, I think, was he was a very early diagnostician of the way in which the mass media and the celebrity culture, so to speak, exteriorizes a certain fantasy life. That's to say, from Monroe, Lady Diana onwards, a whole string of them, and he got into this very early. I mean, this was written, it was published, I think, in 1673. It was pretty early. He saw the mass media, even that early on, as being a kind of, as producing images of violence from a kind of collective unconscious, which served the purposes, obviously, of those who produced them, but also satisfied us, the participants, the viewers, the spectators. Media violence was almost like a kind of ectoplasm, which came from the deep hidden unconscious of the culture. And so we were all, in some sense, I mean, his even more shocking novel, in some ways, The Atrocity Exhibition, which I think is the most radical experimental novel, is all about the way in which sanity, he thought, was not so much threatened as preserved by horrible, terrifying, hideous images of media violence, and from Vietnam particularly. And he drew attention, I think, in a comment he later made about the Atrocity novel. He said if he'd gone to a fight with an American poet at a dinner one night in the 70s who objected to Ballard's view that the most terrible images of violence soon become banalized. They have some kind of therapeutic function, a kind of what psychotherapists sometimes call an abreactive function. They stabilize us, keep us sane, but then they're forgotten. And the poet thought that this was horrific, this was ghastly, it was a terrible trivialization of human tragedy and the obscenity of war and so on. But he said a few weeks later, Ballard was opening a newspaper and he found the famous image of a Vietnamese male being shot in the head. Many of you might have seen that image by a Vietnamese military or special forces. He found that image was being used as a kind of marker for foreign news, and he said the image had been altered to tilt the head of the victim to make it more striking. In other words, it had become, if you like, an advertising icon. So I think Ballard was right about that. I mean, we can be indignant about it, we can be angry, we can be depressed, we can be whatever we like, but it has this role of violence in the media, that kind of reportage, which, by the way, we're not seeing in Afghanistan, and we didn't on the whole thing from Iraq. Things have changed in certain respects. But that kind of violence had a role of mobilizing in a fantasy, and somehow kind of in some kind of way, stabilizing the culture, the economy, and even individual minds, and then being forgotten or banalized or used as advertising. So what does this, though, tell us? And what does this book tell us about violence? There's another quote I'd like to... if I can find it. Here we are. And this is one which I'd completely forgotten when I read the book. I mean, it's a very forbidding book, I think, in many ways. You can't open this book and not realize that you have a writer at the very extremes of human expression, of human imagination. And this is the author, Ballard himself, who, by the way, not long after this was written, did have a car crash, very like the one he described. He said, life imitated art. He said, this is it. Glass aeroplanes climbed into the sky above the airport. Through the brittle air, I watched the traffic move along the motorway. The memories of the beautiful vehicles I had seen soaring down the concrete lanes transformed these once oppressive jams and tailbacks into an endless illuminated queue, patiently waiting for some invisible slip road into the sky. From the balcony of my apartment, I gazed across the landscape below, trying to find this paradisial incline, a mile-wide gradient supported on the shoulders of two archangelic figures onto which all the traffic in the world might flow. Well, it's almost biblical, that language. And what's he trying to do? I mean, the way I interpret it, and here I'll make a distinction for discussion, really, is that there is a literature of violence, and there's also a literature of will death. And they're not always both the same. When I was thinking about what Blake was saying about poetry, I was reminded of the now not often perhaps read, but I think a truly great English poet, Edward Thomas. Now, there's hardly any violence in Edward Thomas. He's not at all like Ted Hughes, but it's a poetry of death. Edward Thomas wrote all of his nearly 200 poems in 2 years. He then went to war in the First World War. And I think, and a lot of the poems are either explicitly or implicitly about death. He coveted death. He found himself locked in a certain kind of introspection, which he couldn't escape. He tried psychoanalysis in its early days, made him worse. Became even more introspective. He wrote books of travel, books of country walks, in which he says during these walks, if you read them, you'll be suddenly puzzled. He said, the other came up and laughed at me, capital O. The other was him. So he was sort of tormented by this, and I think he can't know, of course, can't know for sure. His wife denied it, but I think he went to war in order to die. I think he bequeathed his intractable problems, you might say, to death's discretion. He couldn't solve them himself. And he did die. He was killed in France, and we actually have the notebook he was writing right up to the moment of his death, with almost the day of his death, with some poems. Now, that's the literature of death, of willed death. It's not a, as I say, it's not a fascist literature. It's not a literature which glories in the death of others, but it's a literature larger than Thomas, but he's a good example of it in 20th century English poetry, in which death is, one's own death is adopted or embraced or willed as a way of conferring some kind of meaning on a life which otherwise seems spoilt by damaged meanings or no meaning. And that's something, of course, which no other animal does. I've yet to meet a cat which is tormented by the meaning of its life. Although I did once know a then distinguished philosopher some 30 years ago who told me he persuaded his cat to become a vegan. Presumably on the ground of the hideous cruelty involved in eating mice. When I asked whether the cat ever went out, capital O, it said yes. So perhaps perhaps it wasn't entirely persuaded or converted. But the point is, I think that this kind of literature of violence, of which Ballard's is a rare example, especially the consistency with which he pursues it, the rigour, I would say the moral rigour with which he insists we pay attention to these, to the function that violence has in our lives, in the economy, in the culture, is one which really probes right to the depths of what it means to be human. And it shows that in this respect, at least, I don't know if it is an advantage over the other animals or not, we're not like the other animals. No other animal contrives a complex death for itself. No other animal gets involved in conflicts with its species in order to die, as Thomas, I think, did. And so in a sense, this may be shocking, horrific, and perhaps in some circumstances genuinely dangerous literature of violence nonetheless tells us something about ourselves in which we are truly distinctive in the kingdom of the living. Go on.
Well, now, do animals enjoy inflicting pain and violence? Because
cats do, but I can give you, of course, it's not clear that they empathise with the pain. But I can give you an answer. I asked, I think, probably the world's greatest living primatologist, Dewar. He spent 30 years studying primates and performing experiments, not physical, cruel experiments, simply watching them for 30 years. And I was very questioned, so I said, is there any evidence that, what's the evidence about primates which are closest to us in their genetic makeup and so forth, whether they enjoy cruelty and pain for its own sake? And he said, I've watched them and I've tried to sort of see in them responses to phenomena, including violence, and beauty, he said, interestingly, which humans have. And on beauty, he said, he'd seen chimps watching sunsets for hours. But then he qualified, he said, but I've seen them looking at brick walls. But then he went on, he had seen certain types, and there are very different, apparently, according to him, I'm not an expert, but very, very different behaviours and responses in different types of primates. He said there is some evidence that some of our primate cousins take up violence on each other or on weaker members of their species out of what we would call boredom. So sadism, or cruelty, might not be humanly unique, but what I don't think there's any evidence, I've never heard of any evidence, of primates or dolphins or cats or anyone else, or any other species, inflicting violence on themselves in order to confer meaning on their lives, either by self-damage or by suicide. That's to say, suicide may be, most of the fact the ancient Greeks there, I mean, they glorified it, they valorized it for this reason, a uniquely human property. I don't think there's any evidence of that.
Thank you all for three richly interesting and provoking introductory comments. John, what you're saying there about violence as a natural and human function is something which it's almost an artist's duty to represent, puts me in mind of René Girard's idea of the scapegoat and sacrifice being one of the fundamental ways in which human societies are structured. And there's a story Kazuo Ishiguro tells about his mother coming to England for the first time and for the first couple of years not liking to leave the house because she couldn't believe there were pictures of a half-naked man being tortured on a cross at the corners of all the streets. I was wondering, do you, I suppose again something, Blake, that you've mentioned as well, when you write about violence in as if, you do look at child's play and you talk about art leading to imitation and about the depiction of violence having consequences.
Child's play this being
this horror movie with the character Chucky, which was many of you have seen it at some point, I'm sure, before it was banned 20 years ago or 10 years ago or so. But after writing As If, how did you feel about that? Because they're very sad and awful descriptions of the murder of the child in that book.
Yeah, well, as far as Miss Chucky goes, I think the evidence that this was a copycat crime that had been inspired by the film to commit it was thin. I mean, it's obviously one of the big questions for anybody who depicts violence. I can remember watching an episode of Zed Cars in which P.C. Lynch, exasperated, walked out of the station and threw an empty bottle against a brick wall. And I just had to go and do that afterwards. But I've never been inspired to commit an act of violence as a result of watching a violent movie. There is an argument that there's catharsis, whether it's in film or literature or photographs, that those images of violence take care of our need to commit it. I don't know. I mean, interestingly, Anthony Burgess was quite exercised about it with Clockwork Orange, especially after the film.
Well, that was a test case in a way, because there were fairly obvious copycat beatings of tramps, in fact. They remember for fun, they kick a tramp to death.
Yeah.
And there was enough of that for him to think of withdrawing the book.
Kubrick withdrew the name.
Yeah, and he did mention the name. I mean, it was interesting, just as an aside, to look at the history of violence in movies, where it was all decided from above. Movies did not get violent until 1967, when the Hollywood Code was relaxed. And then suddenly it became a different kind of art form, and the director became the auteur. He took responsibility for it. And there was an enormous escalation of violence around that time. The films I'm thinking of, Bonnie and Clyde, which was 67, I think the first one, The Wild Bunch, which I still think is a very great film, but enormously violent, and seemed to set a standard. And I remember doing a stint as a film reviewer and reviewing a not very good Western. And I said, you know, like all these things, it's just the mild bunch, you know, where it's like the Wild Bunch, but not violent enough. And this was when Bullet was another one, where you have all the technology of what we now take for granted of violent movies, you know. And I'm someone, unlike my wife, who likes nothing more than a $1 billion bloodbath on the screen. She wants to go and see films about, you know, French primary schools. And I said, it's like babysitting watching this one. So, you know, writing has never had that kind of constraint and has always been hugely violent, simply because of there being no authority that says you can't. And again, it's all what really vivifies violence is in writing is the phrase, the blinding of Gloucester in King Lear, bind fast his corky arms, much more violent than our vile jelly, the insult of age at that point. So it's always been, the writer has always taken responsibility for it in the way that the filmmaker hasn't until now.
But there is a difference in movies, I mean, between movies. The only film I myself ever walked out of as a protest was a Tarantino film. I didn't walk out to protest, I just said, I'm not watching this. It's garbage, I'm not watching it. And the reason
Reservoir Dogs, was it? Was it the first one? Reservoir
Dogs. Yeah. It's the first one. And the reason I thought that, or felt that, which I haven't seen it since, but I thought this is, it is the trivialization, it is the, it's turning violence into ballet in a way in which, or choreography, in a way in which, for example, Clockwork Orange, although it has horrible, truly horrible scenes, like the beating of it, and some of them are balletic, doesn't, because it's done with a, in order to capture the horrible brutality. Let me give a contrast. The greatest movie I've ever seen on violence is a Russian movie called Look and See. Ever heard of it? Anybody? It's a film about the Nazi invasion of Belarus. When the Nazis went in, they were told, it's entirely historical in the basic events, that this is a war of extermination. Put aside your scruples. And it's that war seen through the eyes of a child. Now, it's almost unbearable to watch, but unlike Tarantino, you feel an obligation to watch. By the way, it's since recently been investigated that period, and it looks as if between, 25% of the population, a quarter perished. At least a half were dislocated. So imagine what that meant in that period, and of course there was the Stalin period before and after. But the film's about the war, so it's almost unbearable to watch. Although there's almost no physical violence shown, what you simply see is a child reacting to various horrific events, runs off, survives by living in a swamp, as it were, where he's not to pursue. He meets a young woman, they survive together for a while, and so on. And so this leads me to kind of back to writing, which is something, the key is a certain kind of seriousness in the writing. I mean, even back to Patricia Highsmith, she's writing these kind of, in a sense, they're rather cold books about a cold man. I mean, just to think of it, he was a psychopath. If we think of a psychopath as someone who can manipulate or understand the emotions and feelings and sufferings and pain of other human beings, but doesn't feel them himself. So can do whatever feels necessary. So it's a kind of cold view of the world. And yet, it seems to me, because she never turns it into ballet, she never resorts to sensationalism, there's almost no description, certainly no titillating description of the acts that are, of killing that are performed. It's a serious representation of violence in writing in a way that, say, at least the early Tarantino, wasn't to me at all serious, a representation of violence in film.
Yeah. I mean, I share your doubts, and I mean, it's violence as camp, and it also is why I have reservations about Bret Easton Ellis, which I guess is the sort of literature equivalent. In the kitchen, I try to make meatloaf out of the girl. The head in the microwave is now completely black and hairless. You know, I mean, it's so grand guignol, it's campy. And I'm drawn to the realist depiction. I noticed that I haven't seen the new Michael Winterbottom film, about which there has been some discussion because it depicts violence against women. But I was interested by his defence of it. He said, it's more moral to make the violence unwatchable. More moral to make the violence unwatchable, and I know what he means. I mean, it's a realist depiction, and that's what you don't get in Tarantino and Bret Easton Ellis. That's kind of cartoon stuff.
I wonder if they aren't responding to cartoon violence if Bret Easton Ellis and Tarantino are making movies and writing novels after the big cartoon post-1967 movie, and they're parodying it rather than being. I just wonder if they're not actually more satirical in how they go
about it. I mean, I agree with Martin's analysis of escalating violence, though I think certain sorts of violence can't be shown in movies in the way they once were. I mean, having just said about Michael Winterbottom, but I mean, if you watch some of those 50s and 60s British black and white movies, you very often see men hitting women.
Yeah.
And I think that's really shocking now. One does see it on screen.
I'm trying to think of books which, recent books which, in a sense, portray violence in an Homeric way. Because one of the things about Homer, who was sort of Christianized in the European tradition, translated and Christianized, I think is the essentially barbaric quality of much of Homer is lost in that, and it includes a quarter, and if you like, an essentially barbaric attitude to violence as being somehow not purifying, perhaps, because again, there's no notion of evil, I think, in Homer, at least not the sort that we have, but as being potentially admirable in itself. And I guess an example of a modern book of that is Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy, which has its roots in a particular period of American history when some of the southwestern states were anarchic. There was practically no law and order. If you wanted to cross the country, you went right round on a boat instead of going through. There were armies which had been involved in wars with Mexico, had come back, remained armies, but had basically become bandits and were fighting with each other and preying on each other. And again, the story is of a young man who's caught up, kidnapped more or less, and becomes a young boy, actually. I think he's 13 or 14 when it happens to him, becomes part of this way of life, in which there is a tremendous amount of hideous violence. But what Cormac McCarthy tries to do is to, and I think it comes across in a bit of the language, is not to find beauty in the violence, but to set it in a kind of context in which it's somehow compelling and beautiful. And I think he's one of the... I mean, there is a kind of, if you like, an American genre. It's almost impossible, I think, to imagine a European, especially after the 20th century, doing that. But, of course, this is a different kind of war he's writing about, just as horrible in many ways. It's not industrialized war. It's a war which contained extermination, because if you belong to a small, weak group or tribe, you could very well suffer something like genocide. But he's trying to do that. Now, I was very impressed by it, but looking back on it, rereading it, I mean, the language is incredible, it's wonderful.
It's this sort of biblical inevitability he tries to
attaches to the violence,
yeah.
Which is like Homer. I mean, in Homer, there's a fatal inevitability once it gets going. One of the things I remember in Homer, which struck me very much, I think it's in the Iliad, is when two gods turn themselves into vultures, so they can come down and watch with delight the violence they provoked. Now, that's not, so to speak, the Judeo-Christian idea of divinity, is it?
Can I ask you just about the House of Meetings? Is it, because there are a number of very violent scenes in the Gulag, and the kind of violence you write there is quite different to what happens in Yellow Dog. How did you, do you remember approaching them differently?
Well, I did remember a point where earlier, when I was younger, thinking, I'll never be able to do murder. I'm not one of those people who can do that. And I think it's very important for an understanding of J.G. Ballard. And I think Crash is a novel written by someone in shock after a car crash. Where they're in moral disorder and they embrace perversity on a huge scale. But Ballard was... this makes a slight difference, I think. He was trained as a fighter pilot, and I think the isolation of that, he never fought as a pilot. But he also he dissected bodies. He had medical training, and I think there's a fundamental difference between those who've done that and those who haven't. And he was also in Shanghai when the Japanese invaded and saw, and he's throughout his, for several years in his childhood, he said it would not be unusual to see someone beaten to death a few feet away. And there were always corpses on the street every morning when he was driven to school in his Packard, you know, the chauffeur-driven Packard. So Ballard can do death all right, but I always thought I couldn't. And then I had to... My novel about the Gulag is set not at the worst time, but in the post-war years, when Solzhenitsyn was there, when it was not as murderous as it had been during the war and during the terror and earlier on. And there was a period when, for some extraordinary reason, Stalin isolated the politicals. He shipped out the hereditary criminals known as the Urkas. And the politicals couldn't understand what was happening and thought they were actually all going to be shot. But then Solzhenitsyn describes it beautifully. Political looked at political, and not with the usual terrified suspicion of one prisoner at another, because it was all dog eats dog and get your throat cut for half a loaf of bread. They looked and they suddenly became self-aware that they were there as politicals. And they did, in fact, achieve, it's the only example in the whole Soviet experiment, a kind of utopia when they rose up and they stood in three or four rebellions, they stood up together. And the morale was absolutely extraordinary. We stood arm in arm as the tanks came towards us, and everyone, you know, even the most starving, what they call the shit eaters, the people who were the Wicks, the Goners, even they were sort of trembling in this line with amazing belief and esprit de corps and a sense of justice. But before they reached that stage, they had to kill what they call the snakes, who were the informers. And there was one in five or six people was an informer, and they killed them all. And so my hero had to do that. And the fundamental difference between films and literature is that films are about externals and literature is about internals. And it's perfectly possible to be thrilled by Terminator 2 and see it as a spectacle. But a novel can't do that. And as I said again, you have to earn it, and you also have to arrange the story so that there is, that it works out morally, and that there is catharsis. A very, not very well understood process by which pity and terror are purged from the reader or the attendee of, say, King Lear. and somehow the horrible implications of what you write are made into something that you can cherish. And when people say, I found that a depressing book, when they're talking about a book they admire, I just don't understand it. Because I think literature is quite without the capacity to lower the spirits if it's good. And if this were not so, every performance of King Lear would end in a Jonestown.
Open this up to the floor. That's okay. Can you have lights and mics? And if anybody has any questions, could you raise your hand?
You said that in the film industry there's an overarching watchdog who controlled depictions to a certain standard or level, and many books have been banned because of, say, sexual content and perhaps political content, but have there been significant books that have been banned because of violent content, or could you envisage a situation where it would be so extreme that that may happen?
Well, I think it got close to happening, or there was certainly talk of it with William Burroughs, The Naked Lunch, which, if you look at it now, is fantastically violent and disgusting and sort of brilliant, and written by someone with a real sense of literary rhythm. But I can't think of any case of novel being banned for that reason.
Were publishers sort of back off American Psycho, though it did find a publisher later, I think.
One of Ballard's American novel was pulped, I think, the American version of I think either Crash or Atrocity Exhibition was pulped, and there were only two extant copies of that for American edition. So if you find a third, hang on to it. But that was fine. But I can't think of an example. It's interesting that it's a book being actually banned in the West.
It's supplied a lot of not very profound thinkers with slogans like, if you show a weapon of death, crowds cheer. If you show an instrument of life, i.e., a penis, then you're prosecuted in court. writers are, on the whole, self-censoring, and the writer whose aim it is to shock and horrify the audience will usually not be in the mainstream. It'll be an odd case like Desaad, where there is something else going on and not any kind of literary wholeness or integrity.
Maybe literature cannot, by definition, be as graphic as film. Though, by the way, graphic is always used against, his graphic depiction of violence or sex as a bad thing, and actually as a pejorative. And it seems to me, if you manage to make people see it, that's praise. It should be praise. What's wrong with graphic?
It's reality so far outstrips anything that that even the most, the sick in the head writer could ever come up with. I've been reading about the Holocaust, and with the usual sort of incredulity that I've always felt when reading about it. There's something in me that's almost a Holocaust denier, because it was unbelievable. And in fact, it was one of the great weapons of the Nazis. As a Jewish survivor said, unbelievability was their strongest weapon, because the capacity to astonish is for all the great carnivorous events in history. And also because there is no reason for the Holocaust. Even the worst moments, like the terror famine in the USSR, 10 million people had to watch each other starving to death. That means that it was a deliberate famine, man-made famine. You had to watch your children starving to death, 10 million people. But, you know, you can all, in nearly all the Soviet cases, you can say, well, they had to break the peasantry, otherwise they couldn't continue the Soviet experiment. You know, they couldn't have a Bukharin centrist solution to this. You know, either that or abandon the whole experiment. What about the people who've been killed? You know, you can imagine an argument. With the Holocaust, you know, there's a great bit of Primo Levi where he says, he's answering questions in writing about the questions he's most often asked. So, do you understand the nature of Nazi race hatred? He said, I don't understand, and more than that, there's a duty not to understand. When I read that, I felt that I'd really, that this frustration I'd been feeling for decades could relax a little bit. And he said, to understand something, you include it within yourself, you contain it. And this act was so counter-human that you're quite right to reject it. It's your duty to reject it, to reject an understanding of it. And there's that moment when Primo Levi arrives in Auschwitz the first day, and they're all dying of thirst. Thirst is a huge subject in this drama. And they're hanging around in a room, not allowed to sit down, and he sees a fat icicle hanging from the gutter, and he reaches up, snaps it off, and it's slapped away from him by a guard. And he says in his primitive German that he's just learning, he says, Warum, why? Primo Levi says, and the guard says, here is kind of Warum, here there is no why. And that applies to the whole project. There was no why. And it was very often heard by women who were about to be killed when they arrived in the death camps, saying, will you give me a glass of water before you kill me? The sufferings preludial to death are absolutely amazing. This story is stuck in my mind, that a huge consignment of Jews arrived in Treblinka, I think it was, no, Belze. And there were so many corpses to be dealt with that they kept 100 young boys, not even post-adolescent boys, to one side, because they knew the Sonderkommando, who were the Jews who shifted the bodies, would be overwhelmed by the numbers. Then, this was in very early in the morning, in petrifying cold. Then, without giving these 100 boys anything to eat or drink, stripping them naked, flogging them throughout in mud and snow, they were made to shift the bodies of their own people, including their own families, until nightfall. And then, at that point, they were taken to the ravine, and the boys were jostling to be shot, fighting to be first to be shot. Now, what writer would have the, you know, what would you have to go through before you could make that up?
I've mentioned both of these books before tonight, but I'll never forget the first time that I read Crash by Ballard and American Psycho by Easton Ellis. I must say, I disagreed to the point with the idea that Easton Ellis was trying to create a cartoonish vision of violence. I think what maybe he was trying to do was to really challenge the reader and push him and see how far that he could push the reader. And I was just wondering whether, as writers yourself, you felt a similar obligation to really challenge the reader when you were dealing with images of violence.
Whether I did?
Yeah.
No, writing isn't about obligation. It never comes into it, and it's not about decisions either. And whenever people say, why did you decide to write a book about the Gulag or the Holocaust? Decide is always the wrong word, and about is always the wrong preposition. You're writing around it, not about it. And it's not a decision. It's you know, writing involves thousands of decisions on every page, but the big decisions do not come to you like that. Nabokov described it as a throb. And he said, of Lolita, he said, rather misleading this, and I'm not sure, I believe him, but I'm not sure of the application. He said, the first throb of Lolita went through me when I saw in a French newspaper the first drawing ever produced by a monkey, being trained to draw. And the drawing showed the bars of the animals, of the poor creature's cage. Now, how that became Lolita, I mean, one can see that it's a novel about tyranny and power and cruelty. But the monkey trained to speak. I think if it has any application, it's something like this, that the monkey was forced out of its nature. It's not in a nature's... It's not a monkey's nature to draw something. It's not. And Nabokov used to get in a rage at circuses when he saw animals dressed up. He said, an insult to their animal nature. And what he does with Lolita, Humbert Humbert, is take her out of her nature and force her to become this coquette at the age of 12. So you see, it's a very tenuous connection, and never do you feel that you're obliged to do something. You feel it's got to work out morally. I do think that. I don't think there are any great immoral books. I think they do work out. I mean, there are different ways of doing that. All Dickens's villains are either tritely punished or improbably converted, or, you know, a statue falls down on their head or something like that. With Lolita, the moral redemption of Lolita is fantastically complicated, and it's there in every sentence. But that's just part of the artistic challenge. It's not some extraneous idea that says, you know, come on, lad, you've got to make sure this all, you know, you can't be doing otherwise. And it's not like that. It's part of the impulse.
Would you like to? Yeah, no, I was just thinking about the decisions that you make. I mean, Anthony Burgess in The Clockwork Orange, you know, he, for him, part of being able to describe the violence was that he had this invented language which somehow distanced him and the reader from... The defense period
as well. Then.
Yeah, and so he said, I mean, sort of defending that, you know, he said, to Tolchok a Chelovek in the Kishkas doesn't sound as bad as booting a man in the guts. And he has a point. And I suppose with The Ballad of the Yorkshire River, for me, having written the poem in a kind of straight English and thought, God, this is terrible, this doesn't work. I found a language by inventing a narrator whose use of the dialect somehow exposes the misogyny, which is the subject of the poem. So, but you know, you learn as you go along. As Martin says, you're exploring it, but the decisions are technical decisions along the way, I think.
Well, speaking as a reader rather than a writer in this context, I mean, there are some things I just sort of have made a decision not to read. I haven't read, and they may be great books. That's not why I've decided. I haven't read the Kindly Ones. It's a very long book, for one thing.
This is the book about the Holocaust.
It's a book written from within a Nazi. I mean, it's chiefly about the medical thoughts and experiences and reflections of a Nazi. I haven't read that, whereas, and I don't think I will, whereas I've learned a lot by reading, for example, some of the slighter, much slighter, lesser known novels. For example, of Arthur Koestler, there's one called Arrival and Departure, a beautiful little book, which is actually partly about Nazi psychology and is partly based on actual conversations with Koestler himself, who before he fled and so on, he travelled all over Europe and knew a certain category of scientific Nazi, as they thought of themselves, for whom Nazism was a kind of an application of science to... building a new type of human being which involved extermination and genocide and enslavement of most of the human population, but was creating a new human being. So I've learned a lot from that, but entering, so to speak, into the, so to speak, humanizing the... this is not a moral criticism. It's almost an aesthetic criticism. It's sort of humanizing that type of mentality in 1,200, 1,300 pages. Even if it's done with absolute genius... is something which I'm not interested in.
Would it be valid for it to be a moral criticism?
Sorry?
Would it be valid for it for you to have a moral criticism on that?
Of writing, I don't know. I mean, what Oscar Wilde said, there's only good writing and bad writing. I mean, I wouldn't, that wouldn't be the reason. But it's something I'm just not interested in doing. Put it like that.
Not 1,300 pages worth.
Maybe 3 pages.
I just wanted to ask, when you're doing your research on the stories and you're living with it and you're deciding what to write, how to write, how violent, how brutal it's going to get, how does it affect you personally and how long do you live with it? And can you switch off from it or do you find that that's what you're thinking about for quite a long time and does it affect you permanently?
That's a good question, a hard question to answer. I think it doing the reading for these things is actually, it ages you, is what it does. But then once that's been done and it's the work in front of you, then you it's just like writing anything in that you might as well, as far as being a father and a husband are concerned, you might as well just leave a life-size photograph of yourself at the dinner table and tiptoe back to your study. And I remember it gets worse and worse. You become a sort of complete imposter to your family, especially if you're finishing something long. And I remember Salman Rushdie saying, he says, yeah, you come down from your study and you say to your wife, with a sort of horrible sort of rictus of affection on your face, and say, how was your day? And then square brackets, as if I give a shit. And it's really a journey into I wouldn't say solipsism, I'd say the solipsism of the book. You've got to live with the book and keep it all in your head. And that's the same whether it's a comedy or a tragedy.
So you wouldn't be encouraged to the thoughts of somebody who writing about domestic violence, that they've done their research through their own experience rather than book research. I mean, that's what's troubling maybe about the Marquis de Sade. If you read the biography, you know, those abuses described in the fiction took place. So, you know, I think Martin's image of the subconscious doing it while you lie in your hammock, somehow removed from it, is a good one.
You might, John, you might say about the proportion of actual cognition that the unconscious does as opposed to the conscious. It's about a millionth, right?
About?
It's about, the conscious mind does about a millionth of the work.
Yes. Well, I mean, this is what I certainly think, and I'll just illustrate this from a book I'm doing, I've finished now, which is on death, has a section on automatic writing. And automatic writing at the end of the 19th century, start of the 20th century, it almost became the dominant form of psychotherapy. But instead, Freud was interested but didn't take it out. He took up the talking cure, not the writing cure. But it went into what was then called psychical research. And one of the sort of interesting things was it involved people, mostly women, who sat down and wrote things which emerged from the depths of the unconscious. In one case, a not highly educated woman, producing an entire new language which Saussure, the linguist, said was a genuine language. Out of, she said, a childish language, but a genuine language. And that led me to think about this issue of kind of writing, which is that in a way when a writer, a non-fiction writer like myself, said, when you sit down and write, the words do come out of nothing, however much you rework them later. The words come from nowhere. So that's the sense in which they don't involve decisions. So there might be a tremendous amount of labour once those words have emerged. Normally there is, at least a tremendous amount of labour. But actually the emergence of the words is 99%. It comes from, almost, it seems as if it comes out of nothing, but what it comes out of is something in oneself, and one can kind of test this if there are writers here, but kind of, you know, is if you think intensively about what you're writing the night before, many of you, I certainly have this experience, you wake up the next morning with some of the problems ranging from minor ones like punctuation to bigger ones being, if not solved, then hints have emerged in the night. Now, where have they come from? They've come from within. So I think that's always the case. And I would even say if there could be such a thing as sort of entirely conscious writing, it would be bad. And that's my objection to something like Bret Easton Ellis. I think that reads to me as contrived in a way that deep descriptions of violence and of are not. It reads as contrived, as not emerging from the depths of the unconscious the way Crash, I think did, and which it emerged as Martin said, personal experiences of various kinds earlier in the author's life, which he said he spent 20 years forgetting and 20 years remembering through his writing. Had come there. So in effect, actually, not only is most writing unconscious, most of the process that goes into it, but actually I would even say the unconscious origins of it can function at least as one of the tests of its value as writing. Not like you don't need an enormous amount of conscious work on it, but if it's entirely contrived and becomes, so to speak, parodic or ironic or satirical or titillating, then it has no effect. It doesn't have the effect of the power of rewriting.
Is there one more question? There is here in the second row. Just is it your last question?
Yeah. Hi. It's a question directed first to you at the end, and then I'd like to open it out to all of you, if possible. You talked earlier about a film called Look and See that you found particularly horrifying and gruesome to watch, but then you said it was extremely violent, but you almost felt an obligation to watch it. But then later on you talk about books that you couldn't possibly read, like The Kindly Ones, you find them too gruesome. Do you not think there are certain books that we have an obligation to read? Or like Martin was talking earlier about the horrors of the Holocaust and the works of Primo Levi, and almost like why we have memorials at Auschwitz now, we have an obligation to remember them, to know about them, to understand them.
Let me answer briefly with a scene from Look and See. There's a scene in Look and See in which the Germans enter a village. They gather everyone from the village who are cowering in terror into a barn. They put them in the barn and set them alight. Now, that's not the horrible thing. You don't see any of them screaming or burning, actually. But what you do see is the Germans outside clapping as at an opera. Now, I think things like that really happened. So you have to force yourself in a way to watch that. But you're not seeing blood and gore or even scream. There are some screams in the background, but basically you just see a burning barn and people clapping. So that tells you something about Nazi violence, which is very, very important. So I'll make myself watch that even more than once, because it reveals something important. But I won't make myself read even once something which I think is essentially contrived and trashy, like Bret Easton Ellis. I won't even. I mean, it seems to me that it's too conscious, it's too contrived, it's too sodden, it's too. The whole thing is too stylized, let's put it like that, a representation of something which is inherently terrible. So there's a radical difference between the two. And it depends on, I think it depends on the degree of. How can I put it? Someone who writes about these humanly terrible things in ways that. Stylize them more, link them to the too closely to the worlds of fashion or ironize them, I'm suspicious about, because it doesn't come from anything deep. Whereas whether it's a movie or a book which unflinchingly, I mean, the key thing about the movie Look and See is it's filmed with an unswerving glance. And also as you watch it, you have to have an unswerving glance. Because what you see is not titillating, it's not stylized, it's not even gory. There's hardly any gore, practically none in the entire movie. No violence in that sense at all. But what it's about is colossally violent, even though the violence is not shown.
I wonder if you were to find out that was an invented incident, a really powerful and brilliant symbol, the argument would follow then that it would no longer work. Is that right? Or?
No, I don't think so. It could be invented. I mean, I think there were incidents like that.
I think there were dozens.
There were plenty like
that. Yes, I'm sure.
Because what it brings out is the way in which, so to speak, a culture which had been rather refined, which had high art, had produced people who were themselves in one kind of refined. But there was a kind of almost diabolical transposition of that refinement into some of their worst atrocities. But I think there were, as Mark said, I think there were hundreds, actually.
Yeah.
Probably.
Like no, it... mockery became endemic to the Nazis. Torture, preludial to death, and mutilation, postludial. I mean, the moral rot was so extreme.
And as you say, these forms of particularly heroic violence, or the way in which they were kind of pointless. People were dead anyway, or they were... That's the difference. But the difference is, if there's some extra layer of sensationalism in it, which has been contrived as a kind of add-on to the underlying depiction, then that reduces its value to me, and if it reduces it enough, I won't read it. I'll read much of it anyway. I might read the first two pages, but that'll be about it.
Affectlessness is a perfectly genuine literary effect, and I think Ballard does it very well in Crash, I think because the narrator, the main character, is in shock. But with Bret Easton Ellis, in that book, he has written some better things. Mm. You feel that it's affectless because he doesn't care.
Yeah.
He is affectless.
Yeah.
And the literary effect doesn't happen.
It's a very important point. There's the affectlessness of shock, something too terrible to take in. There's the affectlessness of just not bothering. Or seeing what's happening as a kind of curio or a style event.
Yes.
That's what I object to.
So you're not being urged to read American Psycho. But is there an obligation to read certain things? No, we don't. We're resisting the word obligation, but it would be in your interests as a human being in terms of your understanding of moral development to read Primo Levi. Because as a writer, he knows he can focus on the small things that say so much that a huge study of the Holocaust might miss.
And not a word wasted.
Not a word wasted. I'm thinking, say, he describes how one of the key things for survival is a good pair of boots. Mm-hmm. No, that's absolutely key if you hope to get out of it. And the way he talks about it, and once you think about it, you realise, yes, you know, it's crucial. But it's the kind of insight you wouldn't normally get. As you were talking, I was about the Nazis applauding. I was thinking of Orwell's essay or story, whatever you call it, A Hanging, which describes a hanging in Burma. It's I don't know, 6 pages, but I think the description of the hanging itself is very, very brief. It's not particularly violent. There are two things that make that piece immensely powerful. One is that in the middle of this very formal, you know, the officers in charge of the police are trying to make it a very formal occasion. A dog somehow gets into the compound of the yard and jumps up very excitedly, and everybody's very embarrassed about this dog, and you realise, you know, the gravity of what's about to happen. And the other is where the condemned man walking towards the gallows steps round a puddle which is between him and the guy. You know, he's about to die, but as a human being, he has to miss that puddle. Those are sort of telling particulars that a writer can bring to this thing, and it isn't to do with sustained descriptions of violence. Mm.
And also, to say one thing more about Primo Levi, that his Auschwitz book, If This Is a Man, there are others that touch on it, but that is the first and the key one, is published with a companion volume called Sometimes the Truth, Sometimes the Reawakening, which I think is a better title. And the Auschwitz half of it ends rather flat, and then the reawakening begins with a stunning image of these starving remnants of Auschwitz looking out through the winter mist and seeing 4 Russian soldiers on horseback approaching very slowly and very dismayed and looking around at this disgrace, this debauchery of what human beings have got up to, and the prisoners not feeling relieved, but feeling shame, ashamed. But then the Reawakening is a wonderfully comic and joyful book, and there's no violence in it, and I'm sure that was an artistic decision, because there must have been a lot of violence. It's all about getting home after, all about being repatriated on a Russian train that took, you know, it went all the way up into Russia before dropping him off in Italy. And everyone had a huge ration of tobacco given by the Russians, including babies. More than anyone could smoke, including the babies. But it's all, the emphasis is all on is human sort of joyfulness and laughter and generosity. As if the human being is waking up again. And I think, you know, there is a view of the Holocaust that's what we're like, you know. And Primo Levi rejects that, and I would too, and if you read these two books, you would too.
Okay. Thank you very much, and thank you for that last question. I have a couple of brief announcements to make before we finish. You have a little event survey, which we'd really appreciate if you could fill out before you leave and hand to the stewards on your way out. It's a short little note. And on your way out, the stewards will also give you our programme for the next autumn, where among our visiting speakers will be Seamus Heaney in mid-October. And we'll also be having another set of events with Martin and guests discussing topics, I hope, as interestingly as we have done tonight. So can you please join me in thanking John Gray.